good Thursday and welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's show, we hear about different methods to partially mechanize pruning in table grape vineyards with a report from Taylor Chalstrom. And Kylie Harlan will be in with a report on new agriculture emission reduction statistics. I'll have a check-in of regional and national agricultural news as well with a check-in of regional ag news right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Blackberry supplies are starting to grow again after several weeks of short volumes. Overall, there's been more supply in the market this year versus 2021. 2021 was very challenging as supply was limited from February through April, according to Jyoti Bogle, Vice President of Sales for Berry Fresh, based in Dominguez Hills, California. Bogle adds that 2022 has seen a rebound in overall volumes, although April volumes still fell short of market demand. Disease pressure is impacting the spring blackberry crop, specifically
the Tupi variety.
Right now, supplies are primarily from Mexico, though blackberries from the southeast will begin at the start of next month. California and Guatemala are also producing blackberries currently. Varietal development is continuing in blackberries as growers shift away from the aforementioned
Tupi variety.
Blackberries are going through an unprecedented genetic evolution. Multiple headwinds have challenged the status quo and created real innovation. Disease pressure has rapidly forced growers to move away from the Tupi variety into new genetics. Growers are looking at these new varieties to improve flavor, quality, and yields, according to Carlos Correa, CEO of Berry Fresh. In the meantime, Correa says Berry Fresh is excited about both the grower and consumer response to its Sweet Caroline variety, a berry known for its sweet flavor, better shelf life, and significantly higher Brix levels than other varieties. He says they believe Sweet Caroline is the key to accessing the untapped growth potential of the blackberry category. And berries continue to be a star in produce aisles, and Bogle says category growth continues to shift the supply-demand curves in a positive direction. He said the market is soliciting more blackberries, especially as consumers fall in love with the new flavor profiles. These new varieties are creating uniform eating experiences, which generates more consistent consumer purchasing habits. The blackberry commodity is very price elastic. He says they need more consistent product to move away from the wild market swings that this berry suffers. HN Holding LLC, owner of Health Net Restaurants in Calabasas, Sherman Oaks, and Manhattan Beach, is pleased to announce Chris Jenner's equity stake in the company. Ms. Jenner is a Health Net's first investor. The Southern California restaurant chain is known for its fresh ingredients, homemade dressings, and a wide range of vegan, vegetarian, organic, and gluten-free salads, sandwiches, teas, and more. Public recognition of the Health Net brand soared in 2015 when its iconic salad bowls began regularly appearing on a hit show, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, making the chain's Calabasas location a destination for fans and locals. Since then, the restaurant has grown to a globally recognized brand that includes corporate-owned restaurants, a ready-to-sell franchise system, and a licensing business targeting expansion into multiple customer product categories. More recently, the brand has undergone a full-scale creative redevelopment with an eye towards implementing a marketing and licensing program that supports a restaurant chain's global expansion efforts. HealthNet has locations in Calabasas, Sherman Oaks, and a new location in Manhattan Beach, and they plan to add additional openings later this year. The California blueberry harvest is in full swing, and some growers are picking a smaller crop this year after losing fruit to spring frost and hail. The California Blueberry Commission estimates farms will produce 55 million pounds of the fresh berries this year, down from its original projection of 65 million pounds. The current estimate represents a 15% drop from the 2021 crop, which produced 65 million pounds, according to the commission. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reported the 2021 crop at 74.5 million pounds, compared to 79.3 million pounds in 2020. Peak season is expected to be this month and early June, according to the commission. Commission Executive Director Todd Sanders described the weather-related damage, which also affected other state crops, as sporadic. It hit some farms in some locations particularly hard, with others escaping with relatively minimal loss. Blueberries remain a relatively new crop for the Golden State, which did not have much commercial production until about two decades ago, with plantings of heat-tolerant southern highbush varieties. State acreage climbed from about 200 in the late 1990s to about 2,000 by the year 2005, according to USDA. Total state acreage today stands closer to 10,000, according to Sanders. Tulare County remains the largest growing region, followed by San Joaquin County, with Fresno and Kern counties nearly tied for third. Other blueberry growing regions have also expanded production, most notably Georgia and Mexico.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Taylor Chalstrom talks about different methods to partially mechanize pruning in table grape vineyards in this report.
Mechanization is one of the best solutions to reduce labor requirements for vineyard management and lower the production cost. However, even though pruning machines are extensively used in wine grapes grown in the San Joaquin Valley, the mechanization of pruning in table grapes remains challenging. Most of the table grape vineyards grown in the San Joaquin Valley use a Y-trellis system, also known as an open gable system. This highly structured trellis provides adequate support to large canopies of table grape vines, but limits the options of mechanization. In addition, table grapes have high aesthetic requirements. Growers rely on vineyard crews to adjust to the location and numbers of spurs and canes at pruning to maintain vine shape and achieve desirable yield and fruit quality. In this regard, mechanical tools that are currently available cannot mechanize the entire pruning process in table grape vineyards. However, mechanizing part of the process is possible, according to UCCE viticulture farm advisor Tian Tian.
For now, as what the technology available now, we cannot mechanize the entire pruning process in table grapes. So if you're thinking about pruning, it involves in several steps, right? General steps. First is you're cutting the cans to desirable lengths. And the second step is you're pulling those pruned cans off the catching wire and then put in the middle of the ground. And the third is there will be a can shredder and to have passes in the vineyard and to shred those cans into smaller pieces. So the first step, cutting the cans to desirable lengths and then to do the adjustment about the can numbers, the number and the location of those cans. There's no machine can really do it now. There's new technology are evolving, and then we hope 5 years from now, some robots can do it. But that's not something achievable now. So we potentially can mechanize the latter two steps.
Recent University of California research trials looked at the efficacy of pruning in table grapes, or at least partial pruning, using a few different pruning systems, including the Clema cane pruning system, the Andros pre-pruner, as well as battery-powered pruning tools.
First is Andros pre-pruner. Basically, you have a pre-pruner to cut off the cans that is more on the upper to mid canopy. And so at the time when you're pulling those cans and there's less work to do. And the second, like more like a big machine type of pruner, and the way, by the way, it is called Clema Can Shredder. That's a newer concept. So what it does is you just make your can selections and then to cut the cans, and then you don't need to pull them off the vine. The shredder will come in to lift up the wires and shred it along the way. And then later on, you will have a crew to come back to put the wire back to the cross arms. So the third tool we evaluate is a battery-powered pruning shear. Just to say, if you have, you don't need to put so much effort into cutting cans where that make it move faster. And the fourth tool is a battery-powered tire machine. So that is more for can-proof vines where you have a lot of tie-down work need to do. So that's the four methods we evaluate this year.
Results from each method in the trials seem to be promising. For the Andros pre-pruner, the reduction of labor requirements resulted in a savings on average of $40 to $80 on a per-acre basis, depending on the trellis configuration. In vineyards with larger V-cross arms, the cost savings reached $120 to $130 per acre. Battery-powered pruning tools also saw similar labor reductions to the Andros pre-pruner. For the Clima cane pruning system, the non-machine labor hours required to prune vines reduced by 26 to 34%, leading to a savings of $150 to $200 per acre on labor costs. Tian said that all of these methods would still be combined with hand pruning at the end of the day, given the lack of current technology.
People are really important part to doing the cane selections. So there's some companies to develop robots that can finish the work just to make a choice which one to cut, how much to cut, and how you want the spurs to be look like. But that is a rather complicated scenario. So we are still dependent on our experienced field crew members to do that work. So you're right. That's a combination of experienced workers contribute to part of it, and then we just be able to mechanize a part of it, and then so that will be what we can do now. But hopefully, in 5 or 10 years, we have newer technology available that we can mechanize pruning process entirely.
Tian's research group felt that they didn't get the full scope of results from the battery power pruning tools, given the suspicion that workers who participated in the trials didn't get to fully adapt to the new tools, given that they only practiced for a day prior to the evaluation. The team plans to perform more evaluations on the battery powered tools in 2023.
When you have only 2 people using battery powered tubes versus you have 5 or 6, like half of the people in a field crew using the tools, or it's the scale of mechanization really affect how you interpret the data. Because a lot of time pruning, what you are trying to do is to match what the people are working on in the adjacent row look like. So it's possible you can prune faster, but you look at the people around you and just feel, yeah, I should be in an okay speed. But another way to think about that, for the people working with hand shears and versus those people working with battery powered tools, and then they may compare in their speed as well. So that is the psychological part we did not really get into this year. So we hope we can be able to answer the question in the format of if you are able to, you're investing to those tools, and then will that eventually bring a larger economic benefits more than what we saw in our trial this year.
More results to follow on these trials in the coming year. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Schallstrom.
Unsure of your navel orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from navel orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
And in national agricultural news, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has announced $770 million to help create better market opportunities for rural businesses. The investments include $640 million for 122 projects to help people living in socially vulnerable communities. Vilsack says the investments demonstrate how USDA remains committed to helping people in rural America create new and better market opportunities. USDA is making a total of 154 investments through 3 programs specifically designed to create economic opportunities for people and businesses in rural areas. The funding will help rural America keep resources and wealth right at home through job training, business expansion, and technical assistance. It will help communities hire more workers and reach new customers. It will open a door to new economic opportunities for communities and people who historically have lacked access to critical resources and financing. It will also help entrepreneurs and business cooperatives create jobs, grow businesses, and find new and better markets for their products. That according to USDA. Navigating social, environmental, and economic issues facing dairy businesses in a world shifting from COVID-19 restrictions took center stage at the 2022 Dairy Sustainability Alliance Spring Meeting. The Dairy Sustainability Alliance is a multi-stakeholder initiative of the Chuck Goff-founded Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy and includes more than 165 companies and organizations. More than 270 representatives of the dairy value chain organizations, including 25 dairy farmers, attended in person or virtually last week. Many of the organizations have adopted the U.S. Dairy Stewardship Commitment, signaling support for farmers, cooperatives, and processors who voluntarily advance sustainability leadership and transparently report progress. Dairy Management Incorporated and Innovation Center CEO Barbara O'Brien says never has it been more urgent as they work to meet the growing demands and expectations of both customers and consumers around personal wellness, environmental sustainability, and food security. The event showcased many topics in dairy sustainability, highlighting the work of the Alliance. The war in Ukraine is having ramifications far beyond its own borders, especially on the world food and agricultural stage. USA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford has the story.
It's hard to believe that it's been roughly 3 months now since we were shocked by the news.
The full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia's military is underway.
And because of the unjustified attack, and because Ukraine has been a major producer and exporter of corn, wheat, and sunflower oils to the world,
I think you're seeing the world respond and react as it should.
We'll hear about that reaction and find out just what the agricultural situation may be in Ukraine on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
Clearly, you know, there is a ton of interest in Ukraine right now and a ton of uncertainty.
U.S. Department of Agriculture Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski, to reduce that uncertainty, his group has come up with projections for upcoming Ukrainian crop production, production that is vital to the many nations who depend on Ukraine for a substantial amount of their food. Now, we have all seen news reports from the Ukrainian conflict areas, a lot of destruction and disruption being shown. But Mark Jekinowski says, despite the reports we've seen, remarkably,
despite the war, there's field work going on, there's crops being planted, there's wheat getting ready to be harvested.
USDA analysts also looked at whether or not Ukrainian farmers had the seeds and other inputs to put in a crop and the freedom to take care of and harvest crops. So with all of that in mind, here is Outlook Chairman Jekinowski with the USDA production forecasts.
For sunflower seed production of about 11 million metric tons, that's down about 37% from last year. Wheat production at about 21.5 million metric tons. That's down 35% from last year. And corn production at 19.5 million metric tons. That's down about 54% from last year.
So Mark says a definite reduction in output.
But given the field work that we've been able to observe and the data from Ministry of Agriculture and elsewhere suggesting that work is happening, we have some optimism they're going to be able to produce a crop of non-trivial magnitude.
Non-trivial magnitude, but there are challenges here. Mark showed us satellite pictures of Ukrainian farmers bravely trying to plant crops while working around big bomb craters in the fields and suspected mines in the fields. But of course, there's another challenge besides just producing a crop during wartime.
The challenge that is faced in terms of trying to get exports out of Ukraine.
That's U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack just back from a trip to Germany and Poland, during which he met with leaders of the G7 nations, which include many of the major economies of the world. Vilsack also met with his counterpart from Ukraine. And indeed, a major question is, how much of this year's so-called non-trivial production will make it out of the country to those nations that need it? Plus, more urgently, there's about 20% of last season's crops that didn't make it out before the war began and still sit right there. Secretary Vilsack told reporters in Poland it's really a tough problem.
The ports have been blocked or mined, so they're not available. Overland routes need to be established in order to get product to other ports outside of the Black Sea ports that are blocked. To do that requires obviously a lot of trucks and a lot of rail cars, and there's a question about whether or not there are sufficient numbers of those available. But the real challenge is that the rail system in Ukraine is not compatible with the rail systems in some of the other neighboring countries. So the gauges or width of the tracks don't mesh, which means that once you reach a border, literally cars have to be unloaded and reloaded back onto a different track. Obviously, that's time-consuming, expensive, and makes it a bit more difficult to move products in a quick way.
So Vilsack says the G7 meeting issued a special call out to all nations to help find or supply Ukraine with
the cars, the vessels, the loaders that are necessary to move product, developing and identifying storage infrastructure that could be used to, once product is moved, to be stored outside of Ukraine.
So there's a major effort by Ukraine to produce crops and move them to export.
In the meantime, I think it's incumbent upon the other countries, like the United States, to see and look for ways in which we can provide assistance and help to fill whatever void may exist in those countries that have historically relied on Ukrainian grain or oils, to Ethiopia and Sudan and Somalia, South Sudan and other countries that, frankly, wouldn't be able to handle, from a stability standpoint, massive food shortages.
Vilsack says the U.S. has just tapped a special emergency food fund, the Emerson Trust, for $281 million to be used to buy food supplies and is paying for shipment of those supplies to countries in need. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Growing consumption of wine in the U.S. has contributed to an increase in wine imports from 127 million gallons in fiscal year 2000 to 456 million gallons in 2021, reaching nearly $7.5 billion in value. USDA's Economic Research Service reports most wine imports come from the European Union, accounting for 75% of the total value and 50% of the volume. Specifically, the top two countries of origin, Italy and France, each supplied about $2.5 billion in wine imports in 2021, although the volume from Italy was more than twice that of France because of its lower average price. In 2020, imports from the EU temporarily decreased in response to a 25% U.S. tariff placed in late 2019 on French, German, Spanish, and English wine that was lifted in early 2021. While the United States is a net importer of wine, it exported $1.5 billion in 2021 to destinations including Canada, the United Kingdom, and Japan. In recognition of May as Mental Health Month, the American Farm Bureau Federation will host a free virtual event. It's called Farmers Saving Lives on Tuesday, May 31st, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. The live event will feature compelling stories from three Farm Bureau members who believe that advocating for mental health wellness is a way to save lives in rural and farming communities. Farmers, ranchers, and their families are encouraged to attend via telephone, smartphone, or tablet from planters, harvesters, greenhouses, dairy barns, farm trucks, classrooms, and carpool lines. AFBF President Zippy Duvall says they're holding this virtual event on the last day of Mental Health Month to remind everyone that their work does not stop on June 1st. It continues throughout the year. According to AFBF national research polls, a strong majority of farmers and farm workers say financial issues, farm or business problems, or fear of losing the farm impact farmers' mental health. For more information and to register online, go to fb.org. A bipartisan group of senators have sent a letter to the Surface Transportation Board Chairman Martin Oberman stating concern over current logistics issues. The May 23rd letter from 21 senators outlines issues raised by customers and labor organizations at the April 26th and 27th STB hearings and additional issues since that hearing. According to the letter, they are very concerned over the significant rail service disruptions occurring throughout the U.S. freight rail network. Reports from rail customers, including manufacturers, farmers, ranchers, and energy producers, indicate reliable rail service is not being provided in many situations. The letter goes on to say, similarly, shippers have little recourse or alternative options to get their goods to market. The senators reiterated comments from the hearing that in some instances, rail service problems have forced producers to curtail or temporarily stop production altogether. Further accounts of lengthy delays and unpredictable service paint a troubling picture of the conditions that the nation's commerce currently faces. 21 U.S. senators signed on to that letter.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
And now with a report on new agriculture emission reduction statistics, here's Kylie Harlan.
Since 1990, the EPA has published an inventory of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and sinks. This report is an accounting estimate of all man-made greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., as well as estimates the amount of carbon that is trapped by forestry and in vegetation soil. Shelby Myers, an economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation, breaks down the most recent report.
I think it's really important to note that overall, the U.S. for every sector decreased emissions from 2019 to 2020 by 10.6%. What's really important about that is that we were moving from 2019, which was a fairly normal year, to 2020, which was a COVID year. And so you certainly see a lot of the economic sectors that experienced complete and total shutdowns and slowed production rates and, you know, all of the turmoil that we saw largely as a result of COVID-19 reductions of travel and economic activity certainly had a large impact on that. You know, for agriculture in particular, we also experienced a decrease in emissions, and I think that's something we're celebrating as well.
The U.S. agriculture industry represents only 10% of the country's total greenhouse gas emissions, and agriculturalists are working hard to do their part in reducing emissions. From 2019 to 2020, the industry managed to decrease emissions by 10.6%, as well as sequester more carbon in 2020 than they did in 2019.
The results of the report really emphasize how these voluntary market and incentive-based strategies that we talk about agriculture needing to implement, conservation practices that help farmers and ranchers access the finances that they need to do the research and technology for some of these practices to transition to the practices that are being asked of them. This report certainly emphasizes how important they are, but also how successful they can be. And we certainly have seen that over the course of this report and how implementing those has helped agriculture manage its emissions as well as increase its carbon sink capacity. You look at the number for land use change in forestry, that sector captured nearly 757 million metric tons of emissions in 2020, which is an increase of 3.7%, in addition to every other sector decreasing the emission outputs that it produced.
Meyer says these statistics are collected in a variety of ways and that the methodology of the report is very extensive.
EPA uses an extensive various types of methodology to calculate this. They also may use another methodology that's consistent with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. So there's kind of two different ways to do that. The majority of the report is over 600 pages long, maybe over 800 pages now that I've just said that too. And large portions of the report are dedicated to explaining the methodology that they follow.
This report helps American Farm Bureau Federation identify improvements that have been made within the agriculture industry, as well as what the industry should be working towards. Perhaps most importantly, though, Meyer says the report highlights agriculture's productivity and how we are doing more with less and doing it well.
Agriculture and agriculture emissions year by year, going back all the way to 1990, having the report for this information and access to the data that it provides certainly helps us tell a story, right? And helps agriculture be able to pinpoint what our role is in the sustainability and climate conversations, and to help us point to the things that we're improving. It's a great aggregated assessment of what we're doing, and breaks down, you know, U.S. agriculture emissions all the way down to the type of greenhouse gas that we're emitting and by, you know, which source of emission that is, whether that's agricultural soil management, like fertilizer application or tillage practices, or it's, rice cultivation or manure management, enteric fermentation. They've even broken it further down to how much carbon dioxide is being emitted from tractors and vehicles that we're using there. So it's certainly a good estimate of that. I would emphasize the word estimate because, as majority of people know, every farm, every small business is so different. And they're implementing different things that work agronomically and financially viable for that farm. And so, you know, it's this really great job to say, here's what agriculture is doing, what we're working on, and then, you know, on the larger scale, then to tailor it down for our members to say, but on my farm, I also implement some of these other practices that can even further reduce my greenhouse gas footprint. I think the other thing that we like to use this information for is to talk about agriculture's productivity in the U.S. compared to our emissions, and talk about, you know, our ability to do more with less, if you will, that U.S. farms are producing more food, feed, fiber, and renewable fuels without using more resources and helping to conserve, you know, water and soil and enhance biodiversity and conserve our energy. And much of the analyses that we do on our market intel that talks about the 2020 EPA greenhouse gas emissions inventory report has to do with, you know, taking that information and analyzing it on agriculture's productivity rates. You know, what is the per capita emissions of agriculture? Well, over the last 30 years, we've actually decreased emissions by 20% for every person in the U.S. that we fed. And so giving us the ability to talk about doing more with less and celebrating agriculture's wins, while also, you know, showing the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions that we've worked hard to do using these voluntary market-based incentives, have really been a huge win for agriculture.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.